Hello, everyone. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose here on Voice of Vashon. That is KVSH LP 101.9 FM, and my name is March Twisdale, producer and host. Today, I'm going to start off with a few minutes of backstory because my author is a pretty amazing guy and has a lot of interviews right now and is super busy. So I've only got him for about 45 minutes today. So what I want to do is set the stage for our upcoming conversation. And I'm going to do that by talking about a guest author who I interviewed a few years ago. So if you've been listening to my show for a while, then you will probably remember this interview. Kate Moore is a New York Times bestselling author who actually lives in Britain. And she wrote a book called The Radium Girls. Later, it was turned into a Netflix series. So you can also go and watch the Netflix rendition of this story. But I'm sharing it with you because your life and my life and our parents' lives and our grandparents' lives were all impacted by the story. Every single person in the United States of America is impacted. And the reason is because this story, this event that happened, was the reason that OSHA exists. So let me read this to you for a second. The Curie's newly discovered element of radium makes gleaming headlines across the nation as the fresh face of beauty and wonder drug of the medical community. From body lotion to tonic water, the popular new element shines bright in the otherwise dark years of the First World War. Meanwhile, hundreds of girls toil amidst the glowing dust of the radium dial factories. The glittering chemical covers their bodies from head to toe. They light up the night like industrious fireflies. With such a coveted job, these shining girls are the luckiest alive until they begin to fall mysteriously ill. But the factories that once offered golden opportunities are now ignoring all claims of the gruesome side effects and the women's cries of corruption. As the fatal poison of the radium takes hold, the brave shining girls find themselves embroiled in one of the biggest scandals of America's early 20th century and in a groundbreaking battle for workers' rights that will echo for centuries to come. Written with a sparkling voice and breakneck pace, The Radium Girls fully illuminates the inspiring young women exposed to the wonder substance of radium and their awe-inspiring strength in the face of almost impossible circumstances. Their courage and tenacity led to life-changing regulations, research into nuclear bombing, and ultimately saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Some of the interesting tidbits that aren't included in this little bio here are that radium glows in the dark. And when you're trying to fly your airplane and you're flying dark so you can bomb, you know, your enemy, you have to be able to see the dials and be able to understand the instrument panel, even though you have all the lights turned off. But it wasn't just the military. We also had big business. It says here, body lotion to tonic water. Oh my gosh, it's true. They had chocolate enemas. You could grow your hair back, did you know, if you rub this stuff on your scalp. For men, the list was endless. And even though OSHA specifically came out of this, this also speaks to, if you remember Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, which is a must read for every person who wants to get a sense of what can go wrong in American capitalism. And that's okay. It's good to know that, because by understanding that, by accepting the human nature, that some people will completely destroy other humans for their own benefit, it empowers us to say, okay, well, we know that can happen. So now how do we prevent it, right? So if you think about it, The Jungle, I think, was written in 1906. And then you had this going on around World War I. So there were a lot of things that led to ultimately the creation of the FDA and other regulatory agencies. I think most people remember the tapeworm incidents, which was also the roaring 20s or so, maybe a little earlier, where as a diet pill, some guy had the brilliant idea. You would buy a bottle, and at the top of the bottle was like this little packet that had this one pill in it. And then underneath were like, you know, 100 other pills in the bottle or whatever. Well, that first pill that you were instructed to take first, that was a tapeworm. Pop a tapeworm, not realizing what it was, because of course there was no truth in labeling. And so then all the other pills were just sugar pills. So yeah, you're going to lose some weight when you've got a big, fat, happy tapeworm hanging out in your gut, gobbling up all the food you're eating. So long story short, we have regulatory agencies in place for a reason, which of course brings up the whole other question of regulatory capture, because once regulations started to have an impact on the profit-making ability of the corporate world, they're like, well, that's not okay. I mean, sure, it's better for humans, but we really have to care about our profit first. So, oh, what if my buddy over here goes over and heads up the regulatory agency and then goes ahead and makes sure that they, like, you know, give us what we want, and then we can make profit. And so that's, of course, now we've got 100 years later.
And the big issue facing our times is how to deal with regulatory capture.
So what's really interesting about the story is that the military was involved, the profit-making radium industry was involved, the government was involved, the media was involved, and what was interesting, and it comes out in the book, is that there were men and women who did work in the radium factories. The men were at a certain point provided with protective gear, and the women were not provided with protective gear. So what the women were doing is they had a paintbrush, and you had these little teeny tiny, really small instruments that needed to have lines and numbers painted in radium. So you needed a really fine point on your paintbrush in order to get those perfect little lines. And as soon as you'd written a one or a two or a three, that point on your paintbrush would start to open up, right? It would become less pointy. So they spent the entire day, they got radium powder, then they mixed it into a liquid form. That's where the powder got all over their clothing. They probably were breathing it in. It got all over the place. But then they would take their paintbrush, they would dip it in the radium powder or the liquid, and they would paint with it. And then they would put it in their mouth and they would, you know, suck on the tips of the paintbrush in order to pull those little fibers into a nice tight point, dip it in the paint, draw the next number or two, maybe three, put it back in your mouth, make another point, and you do that for 8 hours or 10 hours in a row. And that's why the primary illness that these women started coming down with was mouth cancer, and their teeth started falling out of their mouths, and their bones were destroyed, and they died agonizing deaths. So you would think, when you've got a whole bunch of women who work in a specific sector who are sticking something into their mouth all day long and they start to get mouth cancer, you would think that someone would logically figure it out. And yeah, the women and their husbands and their families, they started to figure it out. But it took years and years before they were able to prove in a court of law that this was really happening to them.
And this is what brings us back full circle to the topic of the interview today.
The corporations, military, government, that triad of entities, they were manipulating and directly paying newspapers to run ads and articles that demeaned, diminished, and castigated these women, that talked about them as being loose women who were, you know, immoral and out having, I don't know, lots of sex, maybe getting diseases. They really made them sound like they were crazy or illogical or ignorant. Just come up with your favorite diminishing concept, and that's what they did. They also made it so that most of the lawyers that were in the towns and cities surrounding these factories were too scared to take on the case on behalf of these women who were dying,
because they were literally being threatened or bribed or otherwise manipulated to refuse.
If a woman started to speak up, she's just going to get fired, right? And these jobs paid better than most other jobs. So the girls were really excited. One of the things they would do is, like, on Fridays when they went to work, they would actually wear their party dresses to work that they wanted to wear out that night. You know, a big band was going to be playing in the city and they wanted to go out dancing with their husband or their boyfriend or whatever, or their girlfriends. And
they would wear their dresses to work so that the powder would get all over their dresses. And then when they left work and they went to the dance venue, they would be glowing as they walked through the dark and as they arrived at the dance venue. And everyone, of course, just thought this was awesome and cool. It was really hard on these families who knew the truth, were experiencing the truth, could prove the truth, but were being suppressed and oppressed, lied about. And if you want to talk about a misinformation campaign, that was happening. So most of the people around them were motivated to not want to believe them. None of the girls who worked in that factory wanted to believe they were going to get mouth cancer. No one in their family who was benefiting from them coming home and bringing home a good paycheck wanted to believe that their daughter had to stop doing that and go do some other job that was less profitable and probably less enjoyable. And apparently there was no one who owned any newspapers at the time who felt that it was safe to actually write something that was contrary to the narrative being put forward by the military government industrial complex. And yet today, 100 years later, we can look back on this and we can be very comfortable evaluating it. We can be very relaxed looking at the data. We have no problem believing that it happened because we know humans do this. We have this easiness of reviewing human mistakes and patterns of behavior and flaws when they're at a distance. But over the past 4 years, has it been so easy for us to see what's happening with regard to government, military, corporate interests, and the manipulation of media? So in a few minutes, Dr. Pierre Corey is going to call in. We're going to talk about his book. And I just want you to keep in mind as we do that, that there are people 30 years from now who are going to look back on what happened between 2020 and now, and they're not going to be emotionally inhibited or uncomfortable evaluating the facts and looking at how human beings behaved. And so the real question is, when it comes to emotional intelligence, how can we best empower ourselves to be comfortable in the moment or very close to the moment, evaluating these types of human motivations, identifying and admitting to ourselves that manipulations are occurring, and staying calm and logical as we assess these really challenging issues in the moment? Because that's not easy. That is a piece of emotional intelligence and preparedness that is really important for us to consider cultivating in ourselves and in our society. So, okie doke, I'm going to hop off for a second and I'll come back in a minute once Pierre calls in. Hey, hey, Pierre, how are you today?
Hey, March, good to see you, or talk to you, I guess.
Yeah, right? Hey, it's so cool. You actually know my first name, given that we've been calling each other Twisdale and Corey now for a couple years.
That's right.
I have to say how really wonderful it was for me to be able to participate in the People's Convoy and meet you and all the other awesome people. So I'm just really glad that happened.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It was unfortunately timed with the breakout of the Ukraine war, so it didn't get the attention it deserved. I think it's an important part of our history, but hopefully history will remember it.
Well, I mean, thank goodness for the Canadians with the Freedom Convoy.
Yes.
That's just like right now, everything that's going on at this moment in Europe with all of the farmers and stuff, maybe they've done this before in the past, but I feel like the Freedom Convoy in Canada really just pointed out to people on the entire globe, thanks to, you know, the internet and our ability to see all this. It's like, look, you have this power, you can do this. And bam, people are just going for it.
Yeah, the People's Convoy, I mean, the Freedom Convoy got a lot of attention, and rightly so, and that's still kind of in the news, right? Recently, they found that the government illegitimately used their Emergency Powers Act, you know, to put down peaceful protests. And so people are not forgetting what they did and why, and they were right. They were right to protest, and, you know, listen, we've endured a violation of so many principles, traditions, constitutional principles in both of our countries.
Laws and rights.
Principles,
yeah.
Informed consent, bodily autonomy, it's shocking. But we need to learn from this time.
Yeah. I think what's really interesting and speaks a bit to what I was talking about earlier before you joined me with regard to Kate Moore's book, The Radium Girls, is that role. I mean, I recently owned a newspaper for a year, so I learned a lot about the media world and how many conglomerates are out there, you know, where you've got thousands of media outlets that are owned by one company. And so when we look at what happened in particular in January-ish of 2022, that was the Freedom Convoy, 22.
Yeah.
When we look at that, what we saw was like, I was lucky. I was blessed to actually have friends in Ottawa, have people on the ground who I knew personally. So through social media and through personal contacts, I could see what was really going on. But if you were elsewhere in the world or in the country of Canada, just watching basically the Canadian media was telling you, it was night and day different. So it was a really perfect example right there, crystal clear example of the misuse of media to paint something for people who are elsewhere and depending upon you for an accurate portrayal to instead give them an inaccurate portrayal. And it was so blatant. I think in a way, blatancy has become like the theme of the past few years, just blatant wrongdoing.
Brazen
that too.
Yeah. And I think many people are learning. You know, the tendency of our consolidated media and how they're using media, I think many people are now aware of that after their experiences in COVID. And you know, I'm just going to go deeper here and be really blunt. I mean, I think of COVID and everything that's happened and all of the behaviors and policies, everything that's been done is the result of a war of information. Whereas in our supposedly long-trusted institutions of media, and even science, where we get our information from, they've been captured and co-opted by very powerful forces, and they've engaged in propaganda and immense amounts of censorship, you know. And for instance, you brought up the Freedom Convoy, right?
Yeah.
You know, the way that major media in Canada portrayed it, I mean, like, literally fringe, radical, white supremacist anti-vaxxers. And when you actually look at the images and you know the people who participated, there were school teachers and cops and just family members, you know, proud parents of children. They brought their children there. It was solidarity and community. And they saw that their government was overreaching to these incredible extents and they were pushing back.
Yeah. And I think it was, I remember for me, because I was so closely involved and connected, lots of pertinent details sort of stuck out because they contrasted with, as you say, sort of that misinformation campaign that ironically was coming from the top down. And so one of it, when they would say, like, you know, well, they would either use anti-vaxxers or people who were against, you know, getting these injections to deal with COVID. And yet at the time, I remember the truckers themselves, even the organized union leadership and whatnot, they were like, we're at a 90% injection compliance rate. Almost everyone out there in their truck who's driving across the country right now, they said, yes, they got these injections. It's not about their personal choices at all. It's about the effect of mandates upon society, of government control upon society, of basically these soft levels of totalitarianism.
Yeah, there's no question. And you know, the examples I brought up, I mean, I want to introduce the term. I think, like, your listeners really need to understand this, is that you know, it's disinformation is a tactic employed by typically industries, but now governments do it, But these are a set of tactics that were first developed in the 1950s mm-hmm. by the tobacco industry. Now, I wouldn't say that they kind of pioneered and perfected it.
Yeah.
And they used it 50 years to try to convince the world that cigarettes weren't bad for you. But you brought up the Radium Girls.
Yeah.
And what happened to them and how they were portrayed in the press and suppressed and censored and mischaracterized. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's early examples of disinformation. And, you know, I never knew what disinformation was. I didn't know what the definition was. I didn't know what the tactics were. And what happened to me is, you know, I'm part of a nonprofit. Me and my colleagues were some of the most published physicians in our specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And when COVID broke out, our sole focus was focusing on studying everything we could about it to develop treatment protocols. And as we started to put out our guidance for treatment, because we're very well known and respected,
mm-hmm.
We saw that our lives were changing, not in very good ways. You know, we became under attack, and, you know, never had we come under more attack than when we started to recommend ivermectin.
Mm-hmm.
And there, our lives started to go sideways real quick. And despite, you know, really productive and celebrated careers, we were well known. I mean, Paul Marek, one of the co-founder, he's internationally known. I was nationally known for my specialty, which was critical care ultrasonography. And, you know, what happened to me, though, is after my testimony and kind of went viral and ivermectin became an issue, you know, besides the fact that I saw lies being printed in newspapers and on television constantly, then we started to see hit jobs on me and Paul, and then our papers started getting retracted. Like,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Right.
I could not figure out what was going on. And what changed my life is in March of 21, this is about 3 or 4 months after my testimony, I got an email one morning, and it was a two-line email. There's a guy by a guy named Professor William Grant, lives in San Francisco, and he's one of the top world researchers, published researchers on vitamin D science.
Yeah.
And all he wrote is he said, "Dear Dr. Corey, what they're doing to ivermectin, they've been doing to vitamin D for decades." And he included a link to an article called The Disinformation Playbook.
Mm.
And I was like, "What is this?" And I click on the link and I read the article and like it exploded my entire world. Like I read this article and I said to myself, March, I said, holy cow, this is exactly what is going on with ivermectin, is that there's a global disinformation campaign directed and targeting ivermectin. They're trying to distort and suppress and mischaracterize the evidence of efficacy. And that literally is what disinformation is. So disinformation is the tactics employed
mm-hmm.
by industries when science emerges that's inconvenient to their interests, right? So go back to the Radium Girl.
Yeah.
Think of that as the definition, right? Science emerged that was inconvenient to the interests of the military-industrial complex at that time. So what did they do? They attacked the source of that emerging data, right? Which are these women who are developing all these mouth cancers
mm-hmm.
and trying to call attention to that they were getting poisoned by radium.
Yeah.
And there's so many examples of that. So, and then tobacco is the flip side, right? Instead of, you know, again, actually it's similar. They wanted to suppress the evidence of toxicity of tobacco, and they did so for 50 years.
Yeah.
And the thing is, all industries employ disinformation tactics. I would say none far more skilled or powerful than the pharmaceutical industry. And I began to learn about it, and it's basically marked my life over these last 3 years that I'm fighting a war against disinformation. And,
right.
you know, disinformation, another way you could say it is propaganda. And what is the enemy of propaganda? Truth.
Yeah.
And truth tellers.
Yeah.
And one of the five tactics, and so if you read the disinformation playbook, it's actually named after American football plays.
Mm-hmm.
So they're called the fake, the fix, the blitz, the diversion, and the screen.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's a very simple article read, and they give these historical examples of different industries and the different campaigns that they deployed when this, like, for instance, asbestos. There's just dozens. Like, one of the more familiar disinformation campaigns is when that pathologist first started to describe chronic traumatic encephalopathy in NFL players.
Oh, yes, exactly.
There's a movie about it.
Yeah,
right?
There is.
Will Smith.
Yeah.
And so what happened there is you had a pathologist who was doing autopsies on retired football players, many of whom had developed mental illness or suicide or had violent outbursts. And he saw that they had microhemorrhages all over their brains. And he wrote a paper on it, and he tried to bring it to public attention. And what did that industry do? The NFL?
Yeah.
They went after him. And then they started publishing countering papers in different journals showing, like, there's this one journal that somebody joked in one article that they called it the Journal of No NFL Concussions. Because they literally published a paper claiming that there were no concussions in the NFL.
I think that's the brazen, blatant piece right there.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm just giving, like, examples to your audience of what happens. And the thing is, so that tactic is called the blitz. They go after the researchers bringing out that science. And so I'm here with you today as a target of the blitz for 3 years because I've been trying to put out the information on early effective repurposed medicines, and I've been attacked, you know, every way from Sunday.
Yeah.
And I've had to watch fraudulent papers be published in journals, and, you know, and that's all part of those tactics, and that's what I've been trying to fight. But it's really hard because of what you said, the consolidation of the media. The capture of the agencies. I mean, industries are really running media. They're running public health. Mm-hmm. They're running our federal legislature. And so it's really hard to get truth out. And you know, I don't want to sound grandiose, but I would consider myself a truth teller. And I know what happens when you try to tell the truth against those interests. They come after you. And I would say the most famous truth teller in modern times is Bobby Kennedy. I mean, he has endured nothing but mischaracterization, censoring, and attacks for 18 years. He's the only presidential candidate in history who has not been offered Secret Service protection.
Yeah.
I mean, he is so vilified because he produces some really inconvenient truths to those in power.
Well, so real quick, so right now I'm holding in my hands the war on ivermectin, the medicine that saved millions and could have ended the pandemic by Dr. Pierre Corey. And so it's this really... So I found your storytelling, your delivery to actually be super, super, how do I put this? Like, enjoyable. And I'm saying this because it was an uncomfortable. Now, for me, it was mostly a listen. I got the book so I could go through and make notes for our interview. But I actually had gotten the book on Audible and listened to it while I was going on walks and stuff. And so for me personally, having been... clearly directly involved in this situation at a level that's, I was never just sort of, I don't know how to put it. Everyone's been uncomfortable for the past few years, but I guess like you, I've been a truth teller, a truth seer, reader, discusser. You know, it's like I've really gone through a small teeny smidgen of the gauntlet that you have endured. And that's just, I mean, I actually have done a lot. I've been on interviews and a lot of different things. But I was never personally harmed or threatened or impacted the way you've been. Still, I knew what was going on to people I cared about. And so it was interesting as I was listening to this, and I actually suggest this as a pro. For a lot of people, the experience was sort of a visceral remembering because you do it chronologically. And you kept bringing up these things where I'd go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Ooh, you know, and I'd like get the EBGBs and I'd be like, oh, my head's hurting, you know, not in a bad way, but more like, you know, going, it was almost like it was a re-experiencing of very challenging things. And but my whole point at the beginning of this is that your delivery is as it is right now in this interview. You know, it's fluid, it's human, it's real. It's got a storytelling ambiance to it. So as a read, this book is really worth picking up, especially for people who it took a while to cotton on to what was happening, you know, and you're sort of like, oh, like, for example, a lot of people might have missed in the first year, they might have missed the fact that why was it that you had to make it so that on a global level, there was this decision that nothing that existed on the planet could possibly help a person face off with COVID of the entire pharmacopoeia, whatever we call it. All of the medicines on the planet were all ineffective. There was nothing that could help you. And therefore, we entered into this special little space where, guess what? Because there's nothing that'll help, you can now essentially experiment on the population. You can fast track something so quickly that, you know, and the justification is, well, we have nothing else, so therefore this risk is acceptable. A lot of people didn't catch that in 2020. And then you're off into vaccine passport land and mandate land, and people got distracted by that. So why don't you, with some better, eloquent, educated language, really quickly re-explain that little loophole thing that they were aiming for?
Yeah, so, yeah, and you're absolutely right. You know, we're going back to the days of, sorry to say it, stay home until your lips turn blue, right?
Yeah.
You remember that? I mean, literally, you know, we had those in authority basically claiming that there's no treatment for this novel virus and making us dependent on what they were going to come up with. And, you know, I always remember the words of my partner, Paul Marek. He immediately said in the beginning, he said, there is no disease that you cannot treat. You can always treat diseases.
Right.
We can figure it out. We can use educated judgment, knowledge of mechanisms, try combinations, and yet they didn't want to do that. And the reason why, right, and the first thing they did, so one of the things I want to say, March, is I wrote the book, The War on Ivermectin. One of my colleagues, like Peter McCullough, one of my colleagues could have written the book, The War on Hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah.
Because it was the same war.
Yeah.
Same tactics, same results. Like, the tactics were identical. And, you know, and that war on hydroxychloroquine was done in the face of Fauci on record. In the past, around the prior pandemics, saying that hydroxychloroquine was effective. But yet when people started to treat it, and remember the other organization, America's Frontline Doctors, that's not mine. Mine's Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, or FLCCC.
Mm-hmm.
But when they came out and talked about the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine, when you saw how the media attacked them,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was vicious, absolutely vicious. But the reason, like you said, your question, the reason why that was done is in order to embark on a global vaccination campaign, you needed an emergency use authorization. And the only way you could be granted one is if no other effective treatments were identified or available. So this was all about a vaccine response.
Right.
And they needed to clear the way in order to have that vaccine get propelled throughout the world. And so early treatments were immediately attacked. And all my whole network of colleagues in COVID, I mean, we've all endured it, and we've been trying to fight the good fight, but we were up against some really vested interests and some powerful foes.
Right. You know, it's interesting, early on, my dad was involved in the internet back before, like, any common people were, when it was just a university product, you know, a tool.
Mm.
And he worked at a university, UCSB. And so he, as an editor, would use it in order to go in and check out German abstracts and all this cool stuff he did, right? So when I grew up and we had, like, a medical question in the family about something, he would say, oh, hold on, let me go in. And he just had this weirdly abnormal access to medical studies that most common people didn't have. And he'd say, give me a week, I'll go dig around on that topic and I'll give you feedback. And I remember once there was this new product that they wanted to use on me. And I asked him, he's like, wait. And he went and he checked it out and he comes back. He goes, no, don't. He's like, I read all these studies, you know. So that's how I grew up, as a family culture. And that's my dad. And then, of course, my mom and my stepdad owned a medical practice. And so I grew up with medical journals everywhere and talking about stuff over the dinner table. So I'm very much, that's my family background. So when this first started, things first started hitting off, I dug around. I said, well, what did they figure out worked for SARS? You know, and so SARS, roughly around 2003, there were a bunch of CDC articles, for lack of a better word, and studies and whatnot, that were celebrating, and Fauci was, I know Fauci was involved in some of this. There was, like, this global celebration around 2003 or so, because chloroquine had been identified as being super effective at dealing with SARS. So when I found that in, I think it was the middle of March, and I was interviewed James Lyons Weiler at that point. Mm. I called him up and said, dude, I'd interviewed him once before. I said, hey, this thing's hitting Washington. Let's do an interview really quick. And he called me the next day and we got it on the radio. Right. And so when I found this information, I was like, OK, well, that's interesting. Chloroquine helped with SARS. And then I was like, I wonder about hydroxychloroquine, which was being talked about a little bit. That would sort of make sense. So it's like, you know, and this is what people should be doing in the modern era when we have access to the internet and the medical world, is that we think, we use these beautiful brains we were gifted with by Mother Nature or God, and we go out there and we educate ourselves and we feel good about it and we talk to people about it, and all of that should be encouraged. And I think one of the pieces of this suppression campaign that we've experienced is, how dare you talk about it? I'm still boggled. I mean, right now, my temperature, my skin just heated up because I'm so angry at that thing where people would be like, you're not a doctor, so you should shut up and not say anything. Honestly, like, my whole body's tingling right now because that enraged me so much that people were telling other people to shut up and stop thinking and just, oh, yeah, okay.
You know, Mark, I got to say something about that. It's shocking, but my experience with COVID has been that I've met innumerable amounts of lay people who are so much more deeply studied and expert on COVID science than the system physician.
Yeah.
And the reason why is they've much more critically examined and done a more broader look at the totality of the evidence, whereas most physicians, they're what we call, I derisively call them ARPs, abstract reading physicians. You know, JAMA hits the kitchen table, or New England Journal of Medicine. They look at a study, they look at the abstract, they're like, yeah, hydroxychloroquine doesn't work. And, you know, I want to say something about hydroxychloroquine, which is really interesting in terms of disinformation, and it's very humbling, is that when we were building protocols, the first protocol we built was a hospital protocol. And I put corticosteroids on there, we all did, because we knew how important it was in the hospital phase of the disease. And we did that at a time when every national and international healthcare organization was recommending against corticosteroids. Mm-hmm. And I testified in the Senate in May of 2020 about the critical need for steroids. I was the chief of critical care at the University of Wisconsin at that time, and I got attacked. The University of Wisconsin was livid that I went out in public in the Senate and made a recommendation which ran counter to the University of Wisconsin and every international, and they wanted me to shut up. Mm-hmm. Now, they forgot about something called academic freedom. In fact, as a professor, you're supposed to share your expertise with the world.
Right.
But they wanted to censor me.
Yeah.
But so we worked on a hospital protocol, but here's the really crazy thing, is me and my colleagues, we actually fell victim to the disinformation campaign against hydroxychloroquine. We did not think it worked. We started to see, like, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, we were reading the papers, and the first few randomized controlled trials that came out on were all negative.
Right.
And that was at a time when we really trusted. We thought the best science and scientists were in those high-impact journals. And so we did, and we actually thought America's frontline doctors were a little kooky. We thought they were crazy because they were saying that, you know, hydroxychloroquine, but we were like, look at all these studies. It shows it doesn't work. We had a lot to learn. And it was only later when we became an expert on ivermectin, and I was treating people with ivermectin, and I saw how absolutely gangbusters effective it was. And then we started to get attacked in the same way. And to be honest, I believe that hydroxychloroquine worked a lot earlier than Paul, because I was looking at all of these observational randomized controlled trials across the world, of which now for hydroxychloroquine there's like 450. All of them, when you summarize them, they show all of these consistent benefits. Paul finally, he only finally came around on hydroxychloroquine after he read The Real Anthony Fauci by Bobby Kennedy. Because in that first chapter, Bobby Kennedy describes that war on hydroxychloroquine, and Paul realized that we were fooled with these randomized controlled trials, and then we put hydroxychloroquine. But we were really late to the hydroxychloroquine game because we were victims of disinformation.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate the point you made. What was it, ARP?
Yeah, abstract reading physician.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I have compassion for people who go through the medical education system because it's really rigorous and intense. And of course, that's just to get you started, because then you're going to really learn the majority of it in practice, right? You know, it's through experience and all that that you're going to really. But I think that I don't know if you would agree. I'm curious, because obviously you've been there, done that, is that it seems to me that there might be a personality trait almost that people who want to get involved in medicine, they come to the table, they come to the university with the impression that there is a, like there's a authority, like people who are in authority are to be trusted. And I'm now here lucky enough to be able to learn from all of these people. And so in a way, there's like that power differential they talk about between a patient and a doctor, which is why a doctor cannot date a patient, because you come to the relationship with a, right? Well, the power differential exists also between students at medical schools and the, you know, the staff or the teachers or the professors and whatnot. And it seems like maybe there's almost a dependence upon, there's this thing people talk about in fictional writing, which is when you want to, there's a bunch of books that are about this, the institution concept. So when you're writing a fictional novel, sometimes you're like, oh, this book is an institution story. And it's about, so do you want to speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I think you bring up such a really interesting point, right? So when I think of what it takes to become a doctor, right, you're talking about folks who've had to follow a lot of rules, right? So, I mean, if you come to that, you have to do A, B, C, D. You have to do it well. You have to get good grades. You have to take the test. You have to study hard. You got to go to classes. And, like, they tend to be very rule-following, not disobedient of authority. That's number one. But then the other point you bring up, that hierarchical, like, that authority, like, you come into medicine, and now you're working with people who've been doing this 30 years. Yeah. They have this wealth of knowledge. They have CVs with publications as long as your arm. And so you're very cowed and deferential to them, thinking that they're all-knowing and expert. And let me give you an example, because what I've learned, like in Japan, it's probably the most extreme. Like in Japan, an attending physician, right, the doctor or an overall charge, is so deified, like you never question or correct or suggest anything to them. And I know this from folks who've worked in the device industry. Like, they've gone over to Japan. They've worked with, like, orthopedic surgeons there. And they've told me probably, like, in Japan, if you have a surgeon who's trying to put in, like, a hip implant, and he's messing it up and he's doing it the wrong way, you have to be so careful in how you address that. Like, you can't say, oh, you're doing it wrong. Like, that's how, and, like, one of my clever friends who was in that, he actually is an inventor of a hip implant. He told me that he was in Japan. What he did is he would, like, very gently tell the surgeon, you know, I've worked with some people who thought about doing it this way. Like, I don't know, there's a few different ways to do it, and I know some others who do it this way.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So he had to be extremely tactical and diplomatic. And, but, you know, you're absolutely right. You don't question authority that much. And now, this isn't a time of harm, but I have a very atypical background for a physician. So I'll give you briefly what my little story is.
Yeah.
Number one, I pretty much almost failed out of college. I graduated with a 2.67 GPA. Even though I had fantastic medical school admission scores, I was a screw-up at that age. I was an undeveloped forebrain, hedonistic, you know, party. I'm just going to call it like it was. And, you know, but in my 20s, I kind of wised up, and I learned how to become a man. I became a responsible, productive member. I started working, and I was in the restaurant business for most of my 20s. But I really wanted to become a doctor, so I studied and studied. I went to graduate school. And then when I tried to apply for medical school, none of the American schools would have me. So I went offshore, and I went to medical school at 29 years old. And when I got into medicine, I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. And I also just always questioned why we did things in a certain way. And I found out that medicine was pretty ossified, meaning they were doing things based on knowledge and practices that were 20 and 30 years old.
Sure.
And when I would read new evidence and new physiology, I'd be like, you know, this way we're doing this doesn't make sense. We should be doing it this way. But trying to change something in medicine is really, really hard. Believe me, I've been trying to do that my whole career. But yeah, medicine's an odd institution, like you said, and it's very hard to change things. It's very few question authority, and there's always this appeal to authority. And so I find that doctors are easily led to believing things that either are incorrect or flatly untrue, and never have there been more brazen examples than in COVID. But I've also never seen the censorship and propaganda. I mean, you cannot publish a paper showing the adverse effects of vaccines in modern medical literature. You just can't do it. And it just
well, it's not even easy to do for remdesivir. And hello, if there's something that should be easy to point out, hello, this is horrible, that would be the drug. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. And you know, so the other thing is I appreciate the way you talked about my book because I really told the story from beginning to end. I start with who I was before COVID, what I believe. Like, I venerated the journals. You know, like, I believed the media. I was a religious New York Times reader. I voted Democrat and liberal, you know.
Yep.
I mean, it's just... I believed everything the New York Times said. I thought it was the paper of record. And then throughout my journey, I realized that I was too trusting and believing of institutions that were lying to me.
Yeah.
And that was exposed only through deep study. But I will tell you that that process of awakening and exposure, I know the central events. And for me, the first event, which really shook me to my core, and I remember where I was, it was in, I think, March of 2020. I was driving in my car, listening to the radio. And there was an announcement on the radio that the FDA had restricted the use of hydroxychloroquine to hospital patients only. And I'm in my car, and I'm, like, almost shouting. I'm like, what the heck are you guys doing? You don't use an antiviral on day 10 of a disease. Antivirals are given within the first days of symptoms. And I was like, why would the FDA restrict that drug to a phase of the disease where it's clearly not going to work?
Right.
Clearly not going to work. And I was like, what are they doing? And I mean, I was like pulling my hair out, and I knew something was wrong then. And then what sent me over the edge, which finally just exploded me, was the day that I learned, and this is probably February 21,
mm-hmm.
when I learned that the FDA put on their website that there was no value in checking antibodies before vaccinating. They literally disappeared natural immunity overnight.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's when I knew the fix was in. I was like, how could they do that? They're telling us to vaccinate people who just recovered from COVID?
Yeah.
It was so scientifically preposterous and so brazenly fraudulent. And I knew why they did that, to increase the market of arms they could vaccinate. It was so clear to me, and I was so upset at that time. Remember, I wasn't as cynical as I am now. I mean, that cynicism has been hard-earned over these last 3 or 4 years.
No, the attack the attack on natural immunity was also devastating. It was just, it's like, because every single disease out there, we know that any immune system response you're going to get to a human-made vaccine is attempting to mimic, seeking to arrive at, and hoping to achieve the gold standard value that you get from natural immunity, from your body experiencing the fullness of the disease. And the reason, of course, that it can be better is because if the fullness of the disease is likely to kill you, well, then, let's sort of skip that version, right? You know, so I get it. But, you know, it's when they started actually putting out the idea in the media where they're like, well, we're not sure if you could actually get natural immunity to COVID. Like, they said the sentence, I'm sorry. I just, at a certain point, you just sort of start banging. You just stop watching the media.
It's very hard to not get emotional about because I literally have to watch our scientific apparatus and institutions and media literally scream at the population that there's no evidence that natural immunity is better than vaccine immunity. There's nothing been more absurd.
Yeah.
And when you see that parroted from all of these places in science, they're disappearing a concept which we've known for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and yet they're telling us to get this experimental untested vaccine, even if you've recovered. And you know, what's interesting about that is when the vaccines were first promoted and launched, a lot of people were cautious. My colleagues who are internists, they, without even thinking, when patients would come to their office to ask about the vaccine, whether they should get it, without even thinking, they were like, well, let's check an antibody first.
Yeah.
If you got the antibodies, then I would pass on it.
Yeah.
That's what they were doing. And then how did the FDA respond? They said there's no evidence to suggest that checking antibodies will, you know, demonstrate better protection than a vaccine. No evidence to suggest?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. So the war on ivermectin. Now, here's something I want to finish off on as we run out of time here is that, and thank you so much for gifting me your lunch hour, dude. I appreciate it.
No worries.
So the Bobby Kennedy's book again, the title is
The Real Anthony Fauci.
Exactly. Okay. I personally don't ever read any of those like political books that are out there where they're like talking, where it looks like someone's going to be basically bashing someone else. Like, I think I actually match with a large demographic of people where we tend to be like, oh, I'm going to step back from that. But I listened to the entire book that Bobby Kennedy wrote. And, well, that's his nickname. So I can recommend it. And and the same with yours, because the title of yours, you know, The War on Ivermectin. What I want to say to listeners is that these two books are not a negative experience. They do not have a bashing sensation or feel to them. Your book is way more readable because of your storytelling technique and the way you share everything. The other one was so intense, and I was so familiar with the topics already, so I really was taking me to a whole nother level. And I actually could only listen to about an hour or two at a time, and I had to take like a 2 or 3 day break because of the emotional impact of recognizing what's really been going on, as far as the one about the real Anthony Fauci. But it's not a smear campaign against Anthony Fauci. It's just like, hey, you've been around for a bunch of decades. You want us to like notice that and give you cred for it? Well, we're also going to hold you responsible for what you were responsible for doing during all that time. And the cool thing is, nobody has sued him, you know, the author, right? You know,
that's an important point. Yeah.
Exactly. Because Robert F. Kennedy Jr., as a lawyer, is so exquisitely careful to make sure that everything in that book, and there's a lot in that book, is completely backed up, accurate, and cannot be viewed as slanderous or libelous or anything like that. So it, if you want to understand what's going on in the world today, the global forces that affect your life on a daily basis, both of these books are going to be super valuable.
Thanks much. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I without tooting my own horn, it's interesting. I'll say one last thing about the book.
Yeah.
You know, when I read that article, The Disinformation Playbook, that literally is what triggered the genesis of that book. But
yeah,
I didn't think of a book at the time. When I read that article, I just said to myself, I'm documenting this. History has to understand what's going on with ivermectin. I'm documenting everything they're doing. I'm going to show every tactic that they're pulling from that playbook, because I saw it. As soon as I read that article, I was like, they did this yesterday.
Yep.
They did this 3 times last month. They're doing this right now. And so originally I thought of it as like as a lecture or a talk. And then people came to me and said, you know, you really got to write a book. And I was like, I don't know how to write books. I've never written a book before. And, you know, little by slowly. And then I got some professional help. My co-writer is so brilliant. She's so such a good storyteller.
Jenna McCarthy?
Yeah, she's awesome. And she and I became good friends. And it was a wonderful process writing the book. I mean, she and I were arguing every day because, you know, she's whacking all this stuff that I thought was absolutely critically important and must be included.
She's killing like, no, your babies.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
then I got the lived experience of what it's like to write a book with essentially an editor. And so, but, you know, I'm very proud of the book. I mean, the reviews that I read on, if ever I'm feeling down or beat up, I go read my reviews. Because they're so stupendous. They're so, people really appreciate, like you said, that, you know, I told a good, honest story. I just told my story and everything I learned. And you know, I did that. You know, I'm not really about selling books. And even if I was, I learned, this is the other thing I learned about books. You don't make much money.
Yeah, yeah.
Book accounting for a first book is so miserable that I don't care how many thousands or millions I sell. It's not going to bring me a ton of money. But really, I want people to read it because I think they need to learn about what happened.
Yeah.
Because they got to protect themselves from this disinformation going forward. It's not just pharmaceutical disinformation.
Yeah.
It occurs by every industry on numbers of topics, Ukraine, global warming. All of these things, you see that those in power, they want you to believe something, right? So the definition of propaganda from Professor Mark Crispin Miller, you know, he defines propaganda as a story or a message to get you to think or act in a certain way.
Yeah.
And our media is so full of messages and stories. They want us to believe certain things and act in certain ways. And if you're a modern citizen on this planet and you don't understand that kind of playbook of delivering messages and stories through media to get right. you to think and act in certain ways, you're going to be led to doing really strange things, like
yeah.
showing up for a vaccine after you contract COVID.
Yeah, I know so many. I know so many people. Exactly, they'd be like, oh yeah, you know, I had COVID last month or whatever, or I would know that they had COVID, and then they'd be like, oh, I just went and got my booster, and I'm like, but you just got boosted by having COVID 6 weeks ago. What? Okay. So yeah, dude. Dr. Pierre Corey, always lovely to talk to you.
Thanks, March. I appreciate all that you do, and let's keep going. And I just want to keep going, trying to tell the truth, and hopefully the truth will help people. I know it
yep.
will.
Oh,
they just got to be willing to listen.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. man. Have a great day, and
awesome.
I'll catch up with you soon.
Sounds good, March. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, you're listening to Voice of Vashon. My name is March Twisdale. This is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. I've been interviewing Dr. Pierre Corey. He wrote a book called The War on Ivermectin, the medicine that saved millions and could have ended the pandemic. Thanks for listening. And now I invite you to enjoy the entire song, I Will Not Be Leaving Quietly, by Five Times August.
Smart me, you can shame me and try to blame me. You can do your best to shut me up, but I will not be leaving quietly now. I won't leave, I won't leave. I will not be leaving quietly. I'm gonna stand here and I'll fight for every word. I'm gonna shout the truth until you know it's heard. And label and troll me. You can push me and try to kick me out, but I will not be leaving quietly. No, I won't leave. I won't leave. I will not be leaving quietly. You can mute me, strike and dispute me, dumb down the rest, yeah, but I'll keep refusing. You can pretend like you've seen the last of me, but I will not be.